are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In the late 1800s in Rochester, New York, Monroe County, there were five sensational murders. The first story is about the home invasion murder of a young wife and mother. Her body was found in the cellar, a flour sack tied tightly around her neck and her skirt hiked up. At first, of course, her husband was arrested. Amid rumors, he and his wife were swingers. The husband's supporters protested that he couldn't be the killer. It must have been a transient. The husband was released in favor of a preferable suspect, a damaged young tramp who had been floating around the neighborhood looking for food. In the second story, a woman's husband's head was almost severed, and she was told that he had borrowed from her former husband a very sharp razor and cut his own throat in a suicide. In another story, the resort town of Charlotte, where the rich went to play along the crystal clear waters of Lake Ontario, at night it was where the pickpockets and the thugs went to fleece drunks who still had money in their pockets. After our victim checks into a hotel for the night complaining he'd been mugged, he dies overnight from brain swelling. But who bonked him on the head? The answer seems to come the next day when a man is going around trying to sell the victim's watch. In another story, brother kills brother. The book spans the last years of the gallows in Monroe County and the first of the newfangled electric chair. The book that we're featuring this evening is Filthy Murders of Ye Olde Rochester, Monroe County Homicide in the Era of Jack the Ripper, with my special guest historian and author, Michael Benson. Good evening and welcome back to the program, Michael Benson.
How you doing, Dan? Great to be back.
Thank you so much for this interview and congratulations on this latest book.
Thank you.
Now, the Filthy Murders of Ye Olde Rochester, Monroe County Homicide in the Era of Jack the Ripper, the table of contents, the stories involved are Stone Killer, the Hayward Avenue Horror, the second one is the murder of Charles D'Amico, the third is Carnage at the Cottage Hotel, and fourth is Death on West Avenue and Fratricide at Brown's Crossing. Now, first off, remind us of your true crime origin story. Why do you write about crime and murder in Rochester?
Well, I grew up in a rural area south of Rochester, New York, the end of a dirt road. And when I was 9 years old in 1966, my babysitter, Georgianne Formicola, and her friend, Kathy Bernhardt from down the road, went swimming in a swimming hole behind my house and never came back. It was the first day of summer vacation, the night of graduation at the high school, and they were missing for a month, and their bodies were found in a field to the west of my dad's property, and they disappeared from the swimming hole, which was almost directly behind my house. So then they were found horribly butchered. It was a Jack the Ripper type crime with sexual mutilation and parts removed, implied cannibalism, all of the Jack the Ripper trademarks, and it changed my life horribly. And when I grew up, I became a true crime writer, not a coincidence.
Yes.
I wrote a couple of books that took place in Rochester, Betrayal and Blood and Killer Twins. And then I went back and teamed up with a private detective and the mom of one of the victims who was still alive at the time. And we, as they say in podcast land, we propelled the investigation into a startling new direction. So it was good. I put a Band-Aid at least on a wound from my childhood with that book. And it became very popular in Rochester. They wanted to know what I was going to do for an encore. So I wrote Nightmare in Rochester about the double initial murders that took place there between 1971 and 73. Still, you know, one of my most popular books. And then after that, we took on cold cases, and those turned into Mosquito Point Road in Rochester's most startling crimes. And during my stint as a cold case investigator, I was very unhappy and wore me down emotionally because I was dealing with grieving loved ones and some seriously bad people that I was investigating. So in order to give myself an emotional break and to still please my Rochester audience, I decided to write about 19th century Rochester murders, which are every bit as juicy, but I don't have to feel bad about it and have trouble getting to sleep at night when I write about them.
Absolutely. In the foreword of this book, you title The Sordid Underbelly, you write about a killer in 1888 London who came to be known as Jack the Ripper. And one of the suspects was Francis Tumblety from Rochester.
That's true, yes. Not my favorite suspect, but one of the top five, I would say, amongst experts. He was a Rochesterian. As a boy, he tramped around Erie Canal. He sold snake oil. That's fake medicine, usually some sort of liquor that pretends to cure all your ills. And he sold pornography along the Erie Canal. He was arrested and jailed for a time for possible involvement in the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. He knew John Wilkes Booth. He was in London and frequented the dirty streets of Whitechapel for unsavory purposes at the time of the Ripper murders. And he was arrested as a suspect before being released for lack of evidence and then fleeing back to America. And what's always pointed out is that the murder started soon after he arrived and stopped when he left. Now, December 1888, word got back to Rochester that Tumblety was a Jack the Ripper suspect, and a fellow named Edward Haywood of the Bureau of Accounts in the State Department in Washington, D.C., he's our primary source on all things Tumblety. He had an uncanny ability to run into this guy in different contexts throughout his life. He says, I remember him very well. He used to run about the canal in Rochester, dirty, awkward, ignorant, uncared for, good-for-nothing boy. About 1855, he encountered Tumblety in Detroit, where Tumblety was pretending to be a doctor. To say that Tumblety had no medical training wasn't quite true. He worked briefly with an abortion and venereal disease doctor named Lispinard in a downtown Rochester office in the Reynolds Arcade. But the only known responsibility he had in the doctor's office was sweeping the floors. We know because a patient undergoing an abortion died and Tumblety was arrested, but he was quickly released and it was said that he wasn't really involved. In 1864, he's in Brooklyn, New York. He's charged with fraud for selling snake oil, selling $20 bottle of booze that's supposed to cure people's asthma. 7 years before the Whitechapel murders in 1881, he's in New Orleans, gets arrested for picking pockets. Now, amazingly, Haywood crossed paths with Tumblety on a third time, this time in Washington, D.C., where Tumblety was dressed in a bogus military fatigue uniform and claiming to be on a general staff. Now, he was arrested in Whitechapel at the time of the murders. They're charged with gross indecency after an incident involving a male sex worker. Records show that he was not in jail at the time of any of the Jack the Ripper murders, and when he fled England, the murders stopped. He was later found to have in his possession a collection of women's uteruses.
Wow.
So he had a fascination with parts, as they say. Now, he fits the Ripper profile in some ways. His wife worked as a sex worker, so he may have had a grudge against people practicing prostitution. He was a hater of women with some medical knowledge, sold pornography. I'm an Aaron Kosminski fan. I think he was the best suspect at the time of the murders. But Tumblety's a good one. No evidence that he was a killer by nature, but he was certainly weird and a horrible man. And he was there in Whitechapel when everything happened. He died in 1903 and is buried in Rochester, New York, in Holy Sepulchre Cemetery.
You write about Jack the Ripper because at the same time, 1888, crimes were shocking. The murders were shocking residents in Rochester. And you talk about Rochester at that time, 1887. In fact, Rochester, New York, a 50,000 population, they called it the Flower City. First, it was flour like baking. Then it was flour like the flower. And you say it was the 20th biggest city in the United States at that time.
And growing very rapidly. A lot of the industries that would become part of Rochester's tapestry were just starting up. Sibley, Lindsay, and Kerr, the department store was starting up, and Kodak was just starting. Of course, eventually, Kodak would be a major employer. Probably almost half of Rochesterians worked for Kodak at one time or another. And that was all just starting up. But I found that the crimes in 1888 were a lot like, I felt like an archaeologist. I felt like I was peeling back changes in time and looking at the way things used to be. You know, no radio, no TV. When there's a murder, the way people find out is because little kids would run up and down the street shouting, you know, murder on Hayward Avenue, like town criers. And crowds would gather at crime scenes because it was the major form of entertainment on that particular night. Roads are not the major thoroughfares. Railroads and the Erie Canal are the major thoroughfares, and the canal goes right through downtown Rochester at that time. Today, and for many years, even before I was born, they diverted it, so it now goes around the southern border of the city of Rochester, not through downtown. But at the time, they needed the canal to deliver goods and to take goods out. In terms of crime fighting, one of the first things I noticed was once a bullet went into a body, it tended to stay there. I mean, we're used to having x-ray machines handy in hospitals, and they can take a picture, locate the bullet, and then take the bullet out. Doctors had no clue where the bullet was, and sometimes trying to find the bullet would hurt the patient more than leaving it there. In one case, in Filthy Murders, the victim's injuries are not thought serious at first. The guy's taken to the police station rather than to the hospital, and he has to moan and slump before somebody thinks to pull up his shirt, and there's a gaping wound there.
Yes.
Very little consideration given to the rights of the accused, system in which authorities can railroad someone whenever they want to. Not that that always happened, but they always could if they wanted to. There was no Miranda rights. In the book's featured story, the prisoners kept isolated in the women's jail, which is otherwise empty, which gives us, that's a sign of the times as well. No women prisoners at the time. And he's refused a lawyer. And when he has to talk to somebody with legal knowledge, they tell him to talk to the district attorney. And the district attorney tells him, if you don't confess, now you're going to be executed. So what do you think he does? Now, in the courtroom, I was pleased to find that things are not that different from the way they are today. The key difference was there's no recording equipment in the courtroom. So every newspaper plus the court itself had multiple stenographers taking shorthand during testimony. And those squiggles were later transcribed and published, which made research ridiculously simple in some cases for me. Now, in the world without TV or radio or movies even hadn't been invented yet, the murder cases became the primary sources of entertainment for the residents of the city.
Sure.
And everything that has to do with the crime, the funerals, the court hearings, everything, crowd control is always an issue because a lot of people in Rochester in 1888 had nothing better to do than to want to be the first to find out the news when it came to the most recent horrible thing that had happened.
Yeah. Let's talk about your first story, which demonstrates and illustrates so many of the things that you just mentioned. Let's talk about Stonekiller and the Hayward Avenue Horror. Let's talk about the Stones and their neighbors, the Jones, and the August 16th, 1887.
Well, let's start with the Stones and the Joneses, because they were two married couples. The Stones had a little boy. The Joneses were childless. And throughout the entire case, there's a little smirk in everything you read and in everything everybody says. The Jones and the Stones were close friends, really, really close. Wink, wink. And the implication is, and the whispers start almost immediately following the murder, which we'll get to. But they did a lot of things together. When one couple moved, the other did too. The relationship, if you ask them about the relationship of the foursome, they always use the word intimate, which maybe wasn't intentional, but it's a word that's filled with dynamite and just implies, in dirty-minded people, implies all sorts of things. The story came out that Isabella Jones had once visited the Stone House, which she did most days. And when she left behind a shoe. And that forgotten shoe became Rochester's symbol, what they were certain was a pit of depravity in the Stone House.
Right.
It reminds me a little bit about the John Binet case, where some people will just always believe that something horrible was going on inside that house that led to the murder. But there wasn't, in this case, there wasn't an ounce of evidence to support any of it. But the community's belief always was there. And it didn't help that the Stones were showbiz types. Mrs. Stone was a singer with the Rochester Opera Company, had appeared in The Musketeers, and her husband was in the chorus, and that was how they met. And those show people had a reputation for not being the most Christian and moral.
Now tell us about Ada and Alonzo Stone, but right away you open to Ada in a cellar and two detectives in that cellar and the examination of Alonzo by police.
Right. Well, on August 16th, 1887, it was a warm, perfect day in Rochester, not a cloud in the sky, temperature in the high 70s. And Ada Stone is doing her laundry, tending to her three-year-old boy, when they live in a cream-colored cottage with a cluster of well-tended nasturtiums on either side of the door. A lovely little place. And even though it's Hayward Avenue, very urban now, pretty a rural spot that time. There's a pond and a woods. Alonzo is an industrious young mechanic. The wife's good looking. And they've only been living in that house since May. And of course, the Joneses moved so they could be nearby. The police noticed that the cottage was somewhat isolated. The nearest building was 150 feet away, rather. And there was a house nearby where the construction crew had been working. And that was where Mr. Stone had been working that day. So he was never very far away from the house. The body of Mrs. Stone was found on the dirt cellar floor. She'd been interrupted while doing the laundry. A bag had been tied very tightly around her neck with a single knot under the right ear. It was a flour sack, blood-stained. Detectives assumed the sack must have been one of the items Ada had washed that day because there was not a trace of flour found inside it. The body was dressed in ordinary working clothes, which were soiled with sand, coal, and charcoal, mostly things you would find on the floor of the cellar. And the soiling significantly was on both the victim's inner and outer clothing. Her hair had been pulled out of its do. There were loose hairpins in it. And her clothes were all still on, but her dress and skirt had been pulled up somewhat. Her head was lying on its right side, facing left, and body was on its back. Right arm was stretched out towards the west over her head, hand clenched. This gives you an idea of the euphemistic manner in which newspapers reported the facts back then. This is a quote. The left leg was flexed slightly at the knee, and the right leg was flexed nearly at a right angle. So in other words, her legs were open. Face was discolored, it was dirty yellow color. Features were swollen, tongue protruded, slightly bloody froth exuding from the mouth. There was a puddle of blood under her head, mostly coming from a large gash down to the bone on the right side of her forehead at the hairline. There was no blood on the victim's hands, but there was bruising around the forehead wound, which the detectives estimated to be about 3 inches from her eye. The wound appeared to have been made by a roundish, blunt instrument. Mr. Stone was promptly jailed. Alonzo was taken and put in a cage. Their son Raymond was whisked away by relatives, and he was arrested basically because police figured the husband always did it. Nobody else cared enough to kill the woman.
Right. How did they proceed? You talk about the coroner's inquest, but how do police proceed, and what is the result from the coroner's inquest in terms of any kind of sexual assault?
Well, the coroner determines that no sexual assault was completed, but because of the state of the clothes, district attorney was determined to include attempted sexual assault as part of the indictment package. What happens after Alonzo Stone is arrested is that there's a meeting held in the town, an indignation meeting, they called it. And it was led by a fellow named Professor Coates, the learned Professor Coates, a theological scholar. And he holds this meeting in a church, and they decide that it's ridiculous that Alonzo has been put in jail for this shocking and horrible crime. Could not possibly have been committed by a Rochesterian. That's out of the question. Rochester was too Christian and moral for anything like this to have occurred.
Sure.
You know, one of them. And they kind of storm the police station. And the next morning, they crowd into the courtroom, chant, and the judge says, well, there's really no evidence that Alonzo did it. So they let him go. Now Coates had the ear of the press by that time. The boys from the press are all standing around scribbling notes. And he reminded them and all Rochesterians that the groves, cornfields, and nurseries on the outskirts of the city were infested by scores of tramps whose only visible means of support is theft. The authorities heard that, and a light bulb went on over their head. Now, there's an idea. A tramp, a no-good, dirty tramp. That fit the bill. Mm. So they went looking for tramps and arrested the one who was too slow to run away.
You write that he didn't even fit the description, and yet they found an older tramp and then two boys, they said. And then, like as you write, they tried to arrest them, and two of them ran away, and they were left with one boy, and he fit the bill.
And the boy they catch is a pathetic creature. I mean, it turns out he's only 16 years old. They never stopped and asked themselves. I think this would be the first thing I would have asked myself if I had been an arresting officer back then. Is this guy capable of doing the crime? He had been beaten as an infant. He had a caved-in rib cage, had trouble breathing. He had one side of his face was badly battered. Apparently, one eye no longer faced in the right direction. Gave people the creeps. Yeah. And he was scrawny, and he looked like a fellow who mostly crept around. He had a funny way of shuffling when he walked. probably also due to childhood injuries. And it looked like he was trying to avoid confrontations rather than start them. The thing that he had going against him was that he was a tramp. He was an outsider. And he admitted being in the area at the time of the murder. The primary piece of evidence against him at the trial was his confession, one he repeated a few times because he was told that he would be executed if he didn't confess.
Wow.
During which time he said he entered the Stone house seeking food, ran into an angry Ada Stone who called him names and tried to push him out. He angered and hit her over the head with his stick. He choked her until she was unconscious and maintained through all of his confessions that he never intended to kill her and never planned to sexually attack her. He admitted to dumping her in the basement. He later claimed that the confession was false and that he'd been told that confessing was the only way to save his life and that he'd been put in solitary confinement for weeks, denied a lawyer, and pretty much brainwashed into believing that this was the best thing he could do was to admit to the crime. Trouble was that his confession had details in it that only the police and the killer could know. And when he eventually went to trial and denied that the confession was real, they asked him, how did you know the details? And he said, well, it's easy to fake a confession. They would ask me a question like, did you move the baby carriage off the trap door before pulling the ring and opening it? That was a typical question. Now, in future statements, Deakins always used the ring and the trap door and the baby carriage in his detailed descriptions. And eventually he got it to the point where he could pretty much describe in a vague way the inside of the Stone's house. One thing he got wrong, and which they never called him on because that was the last thing they wanted to do, was the stick he hit Mrs. Stone with. The stick, the murder weapon, was a squared off stake that was designed to be pounded into the ground.
Right.
And Deakins, in all of his confessions, said that it was just a branch that he'd found lying on the ground. So, and he didn't know what he did with it afterwards when the actual killer had put the stake behind the stove right there in the Stone house. If you take out the confession, and in today's court, that confession would not be allowed into right. evidence in a million years. He did it without legal representation, without knowing his rights, misknowing his rights. And if you take away the confession, the evidence against him was flimsy. Prosecution maintained that Deakins put in knowledge of the crime only the murderer could know, and therefore he had to have done it. And women claiming to be Deakins' mother and sister arrived at the trial. Of course, the trial's a circus, the only entertainment in town. These two women show up saying that they're the tramp's mom and sister. They are angrily greeted by the people of Rochester because this was a boy whose life was ruined before he was 1 year old. He'd been horribly beaten, and nobody knew exactly what mom and sis had to do with that, but they weren't greeted warmly. And to show up the kid's on trial for murder while leaving him to tramp around from age 10 to 16, this struck everybody as despicable.
What about the three-year-old? The three-year-old boy is seen by the next-door neighbor, Mrs. McGee. So tell us what it was rumored the boy had said he had seen. What did the boy actually see?
No, we don't know. We don't know what little Raymond said. There was a story very early on. I think even while Alonzo Stone is still in jail, there is a rumor that the little boy says he saw a dirty man beating his mother, which would exonerate Alonzo and would point the finger at a tramp, not necessarily Deakins, but someone like Deakins.
Sure.
But we don't know if that's what he actually said. And it was just a rumor at the time. And he was whisked away and never again is publicly mentioned in any context. Part of the story that didn't make it into the book was an article ran in the Rochester Sunday Herald, September 18th, 1887. The Sunday Herald was not associated with the Weekday Herald. It was kind of a scandal sheet that came out on Sundays, sensationalist. And the paper included publication of something purporting to be the autobiography of Edward Deakins. It was a weird poem in which the writer confessed to killing Mrs. Stone. And though no one had seen the original, the copy read like a dime novel, pulpy and purple, and nothing like one would expect a 16-year-old boy to write. The so-called autobiography contained many adventures, a harrowing accident at sea, a visit to the South, complete with conversation and dialect like in Huckleberry Finn. There were rapes as perpetrator, attempted rapes as victim, and two murders. Now, the other transient characters in the story had nicknames like Four-Track Whitey, Albany Red, Syracuse Charlie, and Troy Shorty. Well, there was no way you could believe it all, and some of it was clearly, obviously fiction, but that particular Sunday paper sold out, And the next Sunday, they reprinted it and sold out a second time. And it contained details of sex crimes men and women of Rochester had never heard before. Reminded me of the Arthur Shawcross trial, which was on live TV in Rochester. And a lot of Rochesterians got certain concepts in their mind for the very first time listening to that trial.
What I wanted to ask was about the eyewitness testimony from the neighbors, the people that said they saw him. And then you write about the actual statements that they said concerning his guilt at trial.
Well, right. I think that if you take away the confession, Edward Deakins is not even a terribly good suspect. He's in the area that morning. He talks to a deaf woman. There's no doubt about it. Talks to a deaf woman. Her daughter translates for them. He gets some food. He's hanging around with other tramps. They're going around together. They stop at an orchard and get apples. But the eyewitness accounts of him are always vague. There's nothing to that specifically Deakins saw a man with a strange walk and an odd eye, a good eye and a bad eye. That would have been evidence that you say, okay, well, it's him. But he's pretty specific in his appearance, and yet all of the descriptions by the eyewitnesses, pretty vague.
You write about the trial and the verdicts, and then amazingly, the jurors come by to say to the accused, nothing personal.
Yeah. You know, the world was civilized in a really strange way. Two things happen in this book that I've never known to happen in recent times. One is just that the jurors say nothing personal, or the killer says nothing personal to the jurors, nothing personal to the eyewitnesses, you know, nothing personal to the people who railroaded him. I think that his life had been so miserable that perhaps happy ending for him had never occurred to him. So he went rather quietly into that good night, I think.
He still denied and said he was innocent right to the very end.
Absolutely. With the noose around his neck. He said, you're hanging an innocent man. And he referred to himself as a man, although to look at him, he was clearly a boy.
Now, you're right, too, that once he was condemned, again, not like today, the newspaper men were obviously let right into the jail. And you write that he at least pretended to be upbeat, somewhat happy, but they said they could see the ruse that it was, that he wasn't so happy.
Yeah, imagine the social pressure on this kid. He's just been condemned to death. He's waiting to be transferred to the prison death house. And, you know, the boys from the press come in to observe like he's a monkey in a zoo. And he puts on a little show for them. You know, I don't care. I'm fine. But they can tell. And I think at one point he starts to laugh and he can't stop laughing. And the laughter is heard throughout the jail and the adjacent police station. And it's giving people, you know, really weirding people out. And finally he stops and, you know, one of the guys from the press says, what's so funny? He says, well, I never did it. And some people thought that was his, you know, one of his final denials of committing the crime. But also, and others thought that he was confessing to being a virgin and that the attempted attack on Mrs. Stone had been unsuccessful. And that was what he was really feeling bad about. But I don't know. I don't know about that.
Let's use this, Michael, as an opportunity to hear from our sponsor. You know, there are times when you just can't trust your gut instinct, and many factors, including stress and poor diet and the use of certain medications, among other factors, can throw off your gut microbiome. So, Ritual created a 3-in-1 supplement with clinically studied prebiotics, probiotics, and a postbiotic to support a balanced gut microbiome. My wife Lisa and I have been taking Ritual's multivitamins for years. So when Ritual introduced Symbiotic Plus, we immediately began adding Symbiotic Plus to our routine first thing every day. Ritual has some other great products we've tried and really liked, such as Ritual's Hyacera Skin Hydration. Daily 3-in-1 prebiotic, probiotic, and postbiotic with two of the world's most clinically studied probiotic strains to support the relief of mild and occasional bloating, gas, and diarrhea. Postbiotics provide fuel to the cells that make up the gut lining to support a healthy gut barrier. Ritual is a female-founded B Corporation, meaning they are holding themselves accountable to not just their company's financial health, but also the health of people and our planet. There's no more shame in your gut game. Symbiotic Plus, and Ritual are here to celebrate, not hide, your insides. Get 20% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/murder. Start Ritual or add Symbiotic Plus to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/murder for 20% off. Now, Michael, let's talk about the next chapter, The Murder of Charles D'Amico, December 23rd, 1891.
Yes. Almost Christmas time. Silver bells. This takes place closer to the center of Rochester. I mean, the first story was out in the outskirts, not the outskirts anymore, but it was at the time. This one takes place right in the gritty, 1891 center of Rochester, New York. By gritty, I mean, I think it's probably hard to imagine how sooty everything was at that time. Everybody burned coal and wood for heat and food. And the air was always smoky, and there was, especially at night, everything was smoky and dark. Anyway, it's December 23rd, 1891, and Charles D'Amico and his wife, Mary, they're a poor couple. They have three kids, all from Mary's previous circumstances, back when she was named Mary Cullen. And they live downtown on Pinnacle Avenue, which is now known as South Clinton Avenue. Both worked different shifts. So Mrs. D'Amico would leave the house in the morning when Charles was getting home from the graveyard shift. Now, on this morning, Charles twice sends out two of the girls to the corner saloon, once with a dime and once with a nickel, and they returned with jars of four and then two fingers of whiskey. So D'Amico's habit is to drink after he gets home from work, which coincides with the girls getting ready to go to school. Now, he was just at the smacking the kids around stage. He did drink all of his whiskey and was flapping him upside the head, telling him to hurry up and get to school, when he complained of a headache and he laid down in the master bedroom. Now, while Mary and the kids were away, Charles was almost beheaded by a razor-sharp blade. There was so much blood that it had soaked the bed, dripped to the bedroom floor, formed a river that ran into the hall, down to the end of the hall, to the stairs, and then down the stairs, and a pool of blood was forming on the main floor at the base of the stairs. It's amazing how much blood is inside one human body. And the force of the blade had been so strong that it cut all the way through the neck and sliced into the pillow under D'Amico's head. Victim's windpipe and jugular were severed. Now, when the people downstairs saw the river of blood, they ran screaming to the nearby home of the homeowner, a fellow named William Cargis, and the landlord went into the house, found the body. He ran out to fetch a doctor, and then halfway changed his mind and instead went to Bender and Schauman's undertaking rooms to find a coroner. Now, hands down, the funniest killer in the book is Jacob Wolfschlager. He was Mary's previous husband, from whom she'd never divorced.
Right.
She told police that he'd gone away and she thought he was dead, but that turned out to be untrue. She'd been married to D'Amico and to Wolfschlager by the same preacher who had been told that Wolfschlager was dead. Wolfschlager had said he was going to go out west, which in 1888 meant Minnesota. He got a job there and he was still sending Mary money because she was his wife. And although he seemed to take it well, he was none too pleased to hear that she'd married D'Amico, telling people that she was a widow, and she'd replaced him in her bed with a younger man. Now, the funny part is, Wolfschlager spoke a tortured German that even German-speaking translators didn't get, and his English was so bad that he didn't communicate well that way either. Now, as the coroner arrived on the scene, Wolfschlager was dancing around screaming, "He killed himself! He killed himself!" Now, the guy's actually practically beheaded, but little by little, authorities figured out that Mary was a bigamist, but she said it was okay because Wolfschlager had a previous wife he'd never divorced, so he was a bigamist too, and fair is fair. Early in the investigation, a cop asked Mary how old Wolfschlager was, and she said, 63 years old, much older than me, but I dare say he has a vigor and appearance of a younger man. Oh, my.
Yeah.
One interesting and sad footnote to this story is that during the investigation, a reporter went to the D'Amico home and mom was not there and dad was dead and previous dad was in jail. The actual dad was unknown. Anyways, he goes to the D'Amico home and the only person home is the 12-year-old daughter, Mary. She lets him in. She's very precocious. He writes extensively about this interview with the 12-year-old. She says that there are areas in the house that have been taped off and they're only allowed to go to the places that aren't. So she gives him an interview. And gives him a little background and more facts that don't jive at all with what Mary was saying when she first talked to police. So the anecdote takes on a sad note when we learn that years later, two of Mary's daughters, and we don't know if one of them was Mary or not, the 12-year-old, but two of Mary's daughters were arrested for vagrancy and immorality. So yeah, I guess the notion of constantly looking for the next husband who will pay the bills even increased in the next generation of girls and Mary's daughters.
What did Mary tell police initially about Wolfschlager? Again, you just mentioned that the idea that she was married to him comes out, but what did she tell police initially that Wolfschlager had said had happened with involving the husband?
Yeah, Wolfschlager said that Charles had asked to borrow his razor, and his razor was sharper than Charles's, apparently.
Right.
And that was the reason why, while attempting to shave himself, he accidentally cut his head off.
Yeah.
So, and that was the story. The police, even 1888, they knew that wasn't right. So, but eventually, I think they figured it out that Wolfschlager, although seemingly a genial guy who was getting along with everybody, there was a time before he went west when he and Mary and Charles all lived in the same apartment. And while he and Mary were man and wife, and Charles was the boarder. And of course, he suspects that when he went away to work, you know, they were doing the deed in back to the apartment, and now all of it right under his nose without him knowing it, until he had to marry the guy before he realized that she was cheating on him.
Tell us about the trial and Judge Rumsey.
The trial was actually pretty brief in this one. There wasn't a lot of argument, you know, other than the guy is insane, which juries almost never go for. The big problem with the trial was that you had a defendant that nobody could understand. You know, and the story came out that he was not actually German. He was Belgian and spoke a weird kind of German, but it wasn't Belgium either. They couldn't find a translator to figure out what the guy was saying half the time, but he was guilty. And everybody knew that.
And you say that he was sentenced to second degree murder and a life sentence.
Well, yeah, there was no way to show premeditation. Clearly, this was a situation that was coming to a head, but I don't think that there was a way to demonstrate that Wolfschlager had plotted out that he was going to go in there, chop off his rival's head, and then claim it was suicide. Of course, I suspect that isn't what happened. It was a hot-blooded crime, and those are usually second-degree murder or manslaughter. You know, it's cold-blooded means that you did it for fun, that you're cool as a cucumber when you did it for money. If you did it because you're really, really steamed and you're just so angry you can't stand it, it's harder to show premeditation because that moment of snapping usually occurs just before the act.
Let's talk about another story just briefly, carnage in the Cottage Hotel.
Yes. Well, you know, this was a revealing story for me because I grew up in a Rochester in which the neighborhood Shalott, spelled like Charlotte, but it's pronounced Shalott.
Right.
Was the northernmost neighborhood in Rochester. It was the part that bordered on Lake Ontario. But back then in 1894, Shalott is a tourist town. It's where you went on weekends. You would take the train out of Rochester, which was the southern part of what we now consider Rochester. And you would go up the finger of Rochester along the river up to the lake. And there were all sorts of hotels and nightclubs and bars and saloons, things like that. And it was a place where people with money went to play and a place where people without money went to steal. So it was quite a crime problem in Shalott at that time. And on August 2nd, 1894, the dead body of Howard Abbott was discovered in a bed at the Cottage Hotel, Ontario Beach, Shalott, New York. We analyzed the moments during the story of both sets of people, both the people without money who are there to steal and the people with money who are there to play. And they interweave on the night of Abbott's death. One nefarious team works the same scam every night. They tell a stranger that there's a corpse over on the beach. You want to go over and see it? Again, this is a world without radio and television, badly right. In need of entertainment.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's go see the dead body. And this works. And of course, they get the guy out on the beach and then they rob him. And that was naturally what everybody thought had happened to Abbott. He'd been robbed and conked over the head. Now, the hotel saloon Where he was found was on the west side of what was then known as Broadway. Today it's Lake Avenue. The main dining room had a high ceiling with a balcony, tables and chairs covering the floor. And Abbott was a fairly well-known guy around Rochester. Rochester was a smaller town then. And he was a rich kid. Rich parents, reputation as a man around town, ladies' man, well-known because, well-known among, mostly among Rochesterian men, because he had been for years the young and charismatic proprietor of a downtown cigar store on East Main Street. Now, as he lay dead in the hotel room, clearly the victim of violence, his watch and chain are missing. And his friends and family thought he'd been the victim of highwaymen mugged and robbed. Now, the next day, a ne'er-do-well named Patrick Gavin is arrested after he goes into a series of bars trying to sell Abbott's watch and chain. So the fact that this ne'er-do-well had the dead man's watch and chain, and the man was dead, this was circumstantial evidence enough to warrant his arrest. Now, the trouble was, Gavin said he found the watch on the ground and had never seen Abbott in his life.
And so how do police proceed with determining that he was involved?
Well, they're desperate for witnesses to demonstrate that it's Gavin who killed Abbott, and not with a lot of luck. It's very dark at night back then, very difficult to recognize anybody more than 20, 30 feet away. The people themselves are sometimes partying. And some of the witnesses were the conductors on streetcars going to and from, who, you know, may have been the only sober ones involved, but were also on the move and working and had distracted attention. So it's very difficult to get any eyewitness testimony to corroborate that that Gavin was Abbott's killer. But they try, and they find that Abbott has some more than one fight during the night. He's very drunk early. He's seen at one point with two women on his arms. Then those women are gone. Then he seems to be unconscious on the ground, very close to a streetcar line. Then he is seen in what they called the closet. It would be the men's room at the hotel, which would be a small building, an outhouse just outside. And he's seen on the ground just outside the outhouse with a man on top of him. And we're to assume that they're fighting and he is being robbed. Although there are explanations for that didn't occur to anybody back in the 19th century. And eventually they do come up with a man who claims to have seen a guy who looked like Gavin hitting a guy who looked like Abbott over the head. And he had a girlfriend who didn't corroborate that she saw it as well, but corroborated that the guy saw what he saw at the time and told her about it. So that's what they had. It was not a great case. And there ended up being, you know, two trials.
Let's use this as an opportunity to listen to these messages. You talk about it wasn't a good trial, but you say the most important witness was the hotel, the night clerk, and his name was Persian, and he was the last man to see him alive. In fact, he had come to the hotel and then requested a wake-up call.
Yeah, well, that's right. He comes to the hotel late at night, bleeding from a cut over his eye. He apparently has a major lump on the back of his head that nobody notices, but he's, you know, how's my eye? How's it look? Well, you're not going to be disfigured. Don't worry about it. You don't need a doctor. He wants a room. There are no rooms. And the clerk gives him his room. Says, okay, well, I'm working tonight. You can sleep in my room. And Abbott, used to being, you know, the rich kid who's in charge, asks for a wake-up call. But the wake-up call turns out to be unnecessary because he never wakes up. He dies in his sleep overnight. And when the guy comes to wake him up, he finds him dead. And that's pretty much where the story starts. And then we have to go back in time, retrace his movements, and find out what happened to him. How did he get clunked on the head? And of course, one theory was that the clunk had not come from an attack at all, but when he was unconscious on the ground near the streetcar line, that he might have been hit on the head by the streetcar and knocked unconscious. But I don't know about that. It could have been that he just had too much to drink and laid down to take a nap, and he was kind of close to the railroad tracks. At one point, the conductor of the streetcar does get off the car and, you know, slaps his face a little bit and says, "You okay, mister?" Says, yeah, I'm just taking a rest. At which point he gets back on the streetcar and leaves. So we're not sure where in Abbott's inebriate night the fatal blow is struck, because he's already groggy and out of it when it happened. It reminds me of a thing that happened to me in Yankee Stadium once. I came out of the men's room and I go back to my seat, and there's a guy sitting in the next section who is unconscious, and there's a trickle of blood coming down his forehead. And I quickly get the gist that a foul ball has just struck him on the head.
Sure.
And the attendants are coming, and his drunk friends are all gathered around. And one of the drunk friends says, "You probably think he was conscious when the ball hit him, huh?" it could have been that the blow may have been fatal because it was administered on top of a brain that was already bleeding from an earlier incident that night.
Yes, that becomes a big issue. What was the contusion and its role in the murder, or the intoxication and that combined with the contusion? So you have that, you write that the first trial is guilty, but then there's a second trial. And we'll leave it at that, what happens remarkably at the second trial. Let's talk about briefly death on West Avenue, the shooting death of James Bovens, August 28, 1894.
Okay, early morning hours, August 28th, 1894, Frank Lorenz's Saloon on West Avenue, to the west of the center of town, two blocks west of Bull's Head, Rochesterians will recognize that, was a bar that was frequented by Italian men. And one thing I learned that I didn't know was that in the 19th century, Italian men are the marginalized minority in Rochester. They are the lowest rung on the social ladder. Juries looked upon Italian man killing Italian man crimes with distaste. Who cares if they kill each other, kind of an attitude. And then it's carried on into the mafia times of the 20th century with Italian men, started apparently even before that. Cops must have responded to the gunshots in the bar quickly, because as they arrive at the saloon, there is still a fight going on. And the man who's been shot is still speaking in complete sentences. A lot of moaning and groaning mixed in. Says, "I know who shot me. It was Frank Gallo." Now, unaware of the seriousness of his injuries, Bovens is taken to the police station and questioned. He's the guy who he slumps over while giving an answer, and they pull up his shirt and they find a gaping wound. No attempts made to remove the bullet because they have no idea where it is. Mm-hmm. But there is profuse internal hemorrhaging, and he eventually dies. But there's a crazy scene at the hospital, where many men, all speaking loudly in Italian, arrive demanding to see Bovens, the victim, because he owed them money.
Wow.
And they want him to pay up before he dies. Among the people is a beautiful woman in a red dress who has a 12-year-old girl with her. And she explains that Bovens was the girl's godfather and had always been kind to them. And then they would cross themselves in unison. Up until noon on August 28th, there was hope that Bovens' life could be saved. But he takes a turn for the worse. There's a last-minute desperate. They drill a hole in his skull. Still doesn't always work, but back then rarely worked, and that sort of hastened his death. The operation lasted for 2 hours. They cranked him full of stimulants, but he died. It's a funny one. He was still clinging on the edge of death, still barely conscious, when Coroner Kleindienst went to the hospital to question him. And during the interview, the victim fell mute. We can only imagine what getting a visit from the coroner while you're still alive must feel like. It's very, very discouraging. So he survived 23 hours after being shot and then died. Now, the motive, according to the official story, was that Bovens had recently lent Gallo $40, and the money was to help bring Gallo's sister in Italy over on the boat. Apparently, Gallo was slow to pay back the loan. But that was only one factor, because during this time, Bovens fell in love with Gallo's sister, who was naive and brand new to the new world. He showed her the ropes. That is, he took her virginity. And one thing led to another, and Gallo wanted Bovens to keep his dirty hands off his sister. And eventually, you know, one shot the other. So as investigators pieced together what happened, the question was it murder? Was it an accident? Was it self-defense? Because there were indications that all three of those things might have happened. So that was what the jury would have to decide.
You say, remarkably, though, he was sentenced to death. He was sentenced to death, regardless of this would seemingly not a first-degree murder whatsoever in his description.
I think that's a lot of the cases in filthy murders, marginalized defendants. The tramp in the first story. The German immigrant who nobody could understand, the Italian men. In fact, I later found a list of homicides in Rochester in the 19th century, and the Italian men killing Italian men crimes had not been included, considered not important, apparently.
It's interesting you say that, too. The victim dies after intense questioning.
Yes. Yeah. He managed, they grilled him before they let him die.
Wow.
But yeah, I mean, today, I'm sure that fellow would have been rushed immediately to the hospital. They would have taken an x-ray. They would have removed the bullet. They just sewed him up, given him a lot of antibiotics, and he would have lived.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting.
Instead, there was a rush to the hospital to cash in those IOUs.
Yeah, incredible. Let's talk about the last chapter, Fratricide at Brown's Crossing. And you say this is less than 3 months after Frank Gallo's, we'll give it away, acquittal. There was another shocking murder on the other west side of Rochester, and it involved brothers.
It occurred on Wilder Street, right? Cousins lived on Wilder Street. Can't wait to send them a copy of the book. Yeah, it's Bauer's Saloon, corner of Wilder and Tonawanda Streets. I think that corner has now become part of the expressway, as happened to many cities. Robert Jones, they designed the city to be a suburban town and took out large segments of the city to build expressways to get cars in and out every day. And this particular intersection is now part of the inner loop, as it's called. Follows two brothers, Andrew, who's 28, and Robert Watt, who's 24. Neither married. Both lived at home with their parents on Wilder Street, which is in the Dutchtown section of the city. And they were two of a family of seven children. The argument began between the brothers in a bar. They started to fight in the bar and were told to take it outside. They'd only gone a few blocks from the saloon door near the railroad crossing on Brown Street. Robert Watt attacked his brother, pulled a knife, fell onto him, plunged the knife twice into him, and then as a final insult, rolled his brother over and slashed him savagely across the face. Robert then fled, got off the street, cut across an open field, and was gone. He tries to escape by hopping a freight train on the Buffalo, Rochester, and Pittsburgh Railroad, but he's caught and hauled back. They had to tell him that his brother was dead. His defense attorney prepared a temporary insanity defense. The defense may not have proven insanity, but it did vividly describe the downward slide of the defendant, culminating with the murder of his brother, an act that weighed a ton of guilt upon his shoulders. This is really a story of a lifelong abuse. I suspect that one brother had bullied the other for 24 years. And finally, the little brother had had enough and fought back in one savage outburst, and had to live the rest of his life in horrible guilt because it was his brother. And, he cried because of the pain he caused his mother.
What was the defense? Very, very interesting at a time before the turn of the 20th century. What was the defense of this crime?
Well, yeah, the defense was that because Robert had suffered a major injury at work, he worked for the railroad, he'd been burned by a steam explosion, and his face, much of his upper body, and had suffered horribly. And apparently, as part of his recovery, had become an alcoholic, part of his pain-killing, because he just stayed drunk all the time. He also developed depression. And although I wouldn't even come close to working today, that the argument by his defense was that this combination of alcoholism and depression had made him temporarily insane. And that was the reason he killed his brother. And that once his insanity was cured, he should be a free man. Now, defenses or juries hate insanity defenses in all of its forms. I can only think of one ever working. That's Reagan's attempted assassin. Usually it doesn't work. And it didn't work here. Although I think that there was a degree of mercy on that jury because they saw a poor beaten brother who fought back once, didn't know where the limits were, and now had to pay the rest of his life for it.
Yes, you're right that he was sentenced to manslaughter in the first degree, a homicide committed without the intention of causing death, but committed with a deadly weapon.
Right. Yeah, he brought a knife to the fist fight.
And you say that he was sentenced to 19 years in Auburn prison, not a psychiatric facility, and with the possibility of parole in 7 years.
Yes, and was unable to determine just how much that he had to serve.
It's very interesting, too. You write that at that time, it was the most expensive trial in Monroe County history at $5,000 total.
Even though it lasted less than a week. And that was because of the The psychiatric defense meant that the prosecution had to get their own psychiatrists and psychologist experts to come in. And the defense used public funds to pay for their own experts. And there was, you know, a whole segment of the trial where competing experts saying he was insane, no, he wasn't, he was insane, no, he wasn't. And they all got paid, you know, far more than your average Rochesterian would get paid. And that's what made it so expensive, even though it had not gone on for a long time.
Absolutely. I want to thank you very much, Michael Benson, for coming on and talking about filthy murders of ye old Rochester, Monroe County homicide in the era of Jack the Ripper. For those people that might want to find out more about your other books, all of your other books, and do you do any social media? Tell us how they could find out about your other work.
I should probably have better social media by this time. It's 2024. You know, hitchhiking on the old information superhighway. But if you Google at author Michael Benson, all one word, you know, the at sign, author Michael Benson, all one word, you'll go to my Facebook page and Amazon page. On Amazon, there are more than one Michael Benson that write books. I'm the one with the white beard. Can't miss me. Hope you enjoy Filthy Murders as much as I enjoyed writing it.
It's been a fascinating time speaking with you, Michael. As always, thank you so much for Filthy Murders of Ye Old Rochester, Monroe County Homicide in the Era of Jack the Ripper. Thank you so much for this interview, and you have a great night.
You too, Dan. Good night.
Good night.